Why do we sound so good? Because we're at Dead Aunt Thelma's studio and Mike Moore is engineering for us. Thanks, Dead Aunt Thelma's. Thanks, Mike.
This moment long ago, many a year we sighed in vain, for both of us knew many a moon would wax and wane before this dream came true. Together with music, the thought of it enchants us so. When those first tones crash out, we know beyond a doubt
that everything's gonna be divine.
Watch us rise and shine, riding as high as the sky. Our hearts are fancy free, because in long, long last we happen to be together with music tonight.
Hi everyone, I'm Susanna Mars, and welcome to Adventures in Artslandia. Ari Shapiro feels like an old friend to me. I hear him practically every day on NPR on All Things Considered. And did you know that he's also a singer? And he moonlights with our own Pink Martini. His concert, Homeward, will be here in Portland, November 16th through the 18th at the World Trade Center. And the show premiered at Joe's Pub in New York. Thanks, Ari, so much for talking to me for a little while.
It's great to join you, Susanna. It's a funny kind of one-way friendship, isn't it, where you hear somebody on the radio and feel like they're talking to you personally but have never actually met them. So it's nice to meet you even remotely here.
I completely agree. So as you told me on email, last week it was transgender sex workers in Indonesia. The week before, it was Republican senators in Washington, D.C. And that does sound like an intro to a really awesome joke. It's actually your life as a journalist.
Yeah, the name All Things Considered is factually true. One of the things that I love about the job is that in a given day, I get to tell stories about business and arts and science and politics and everything else that might be interesting to listeners. So, you know, I get to just feed my curiosity every day.
That sounds incredible.
I grew up listening to NPR, and so it still feels surreal to me that I get to host this show that I was raised on. I have very vivid memories of being a kid sitting in front of the speakers in my parents' house while my mother was making dinner and hearing the All Things Considered theme music. I still have sort of a Pavlovian reaction to those opening bars. I salivate as though dinner is being cooked, which is a real problem because now I have to be talking as I hear that music now that I'm hosting the show.
Oh, that's fantastic. So I don't know if everyone knows this, that you're from Beaverton, Oregon.
Yep. My family moved there when I was 8 years old. We technically live in Portland, but I went to Beaverton High School, so I will accept either title. And I went to high school in Beaverton. My parents still live in Portland. I come back to Portland at least once a year, and I really love the city.
Well, how did you come to your journalistic career?
It was honestly a fluke. I did not write for the school newspaper. I never took a course in journalism. I was an English major, which means I was qualified for nothing. And when I was graduating from Yale, my friend and I sat down and made a list of all the things we could possibly do after we graduated. And she has corrected me on this story. I used to think interning for NPR was on my list. She has informed me in no uncertain terms that it was on her list, and I stole it. So I applied for everything that was on this list I had made, including applying for an NPR internship. And I got rejected for everything, including getting rejected for the NPR internship. Then I found out that Nina Totenberg hires her own interns. She's the legendary legal affairs correspondent
who
has covered the Supreme Court for decades. And so, having been rejected for everything, I went back and tried again, applying specifically to Nina, and she gave me a shot. And so I arrived at NPR just after New Year's Eve in the first days of January 2001, and I never left.
Oh, that's what a great story.
You know, the thing that I think we so often miss in when we hear the stories of people who have been successful is all the ways that they were unsuccessful in the run-up or in the search for success. You know, my bio doesn't list all the jobs that I applied for and got rejected for. My bio doesn't list all the things that I failed to do, the journalism awards that I didn't get, the stories that fell through. And any successful person has far more failure stories than they have success stories. It's just that we don't tell the failure stories. And so I think people get this distorted perception that if they're failing, they're doing something wrong, when in fact, failure is a stop on the path to doing something right.
Right. Oh, I volunteer at the high school and the College and Career Center, so I'm going to excerpt that particular section of this interview to play for
people
them.
People need to know this.
Yeah.
People need to know this.
And that's an incredible piece of advice. So in high school, were you into music back then? Or
yeah.
Yes, you were. So you were singing and being involved in music in your younger years.
I was in choirs. I was in musical theater. At the time, Beaverton had this legendary drama teacher named Jim Erickson.
Jim Erickson.
Wow, yes.
Okay, this is crazy.
Clearly
Jim
legendary.
Erickson directed me in the first show I ever did in Portland.
That's amazing. Did you go to Beaverton High School?
No, I born in Manhattan, raised in Los Angeles, moved here.
Where did he direct you?
At Sylvia's Dinner Theater.
Amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Put me in my first boa, and I never looked back.
What was the show?
It was Side by Side by Sondheim.
Oh, that's so good.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Oh, that's the minute you said Beaverton, I thought, wow, Jim Erickson.
I mean, he would get these teams of parents, many of them mothers, to spend all day just making sets and costumes, and then he would have the students show up before dawn for tap dancing lessons and have work parties on the weekends so they would build sets. He would have these huge, spectacular performances. So I did some theater, of course, with him at Beaverton, and then I also did some shows with the Musical Theater Company and with other...
to know which shows they were just now because, you know, it's kind of crossing over. Do you recall?
Well,
the Musical
Theater
Company.
We're reaching back to the 1990s now.
Mm-hmm.
I was in Babes in Toyland for a couple years running. I was, forgive me, one of the babes.
Of course you were. Vuden,
remember,
as my grandma would say.
What was that?
Vuden, as my grandma would say.
I also did Camelot.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did some things with a little kind of improvisational children's theater company that was in Oaks Park called the Ladybug Theater.
I remember them.
You remember the Ladybug Theater?
Yes,
it was like
I
in this little trailer that was so run down and so charming and adorable.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there would be like kindergartners sitting on the floor and you would be doing these ridiculous improvisational interactive performances.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I did a lot of theater really all over Portland and had a wonderful time doing it. But then, you know, I became a journalist and thought, well, I'm leaving all that behind.
And little and did you know.
Well, journalism did tick a lot of the boxes that performing checked for me. I mean, it involved telling a story, connecting with an audience, hopefully changing people's view of the world.
Mm.
You know, there was a lot about broadcast journalism that I thought, well, you know, this is most of what I really enjoyed about theater, plus a lot of other things too. And I thought that sort of my days of being on a stage were done. And then Thomas Lauderdale, the bandleader for Pink Martini, came along and told me otherwise.
Well, now, how did that come about?
Well, it was, let's see, what year was it? It was about 2008. I had been friends with the band for a while, and whenever they would come through Washington, D.C., I would throw a party for them. I would, you know, have people over for brunch or dinner or a cookout or whatever. And in 2008... Pink Martini was passing through Washington, and at the same time, the band Blind Pilot was in D.C. And I am friends with the Blind Pilot folks and friends with Pink Martini, too. And so it was like summer, and I decided to have
Blind Martini
cookout in my backyard. Blind Martini, exactly. Enough martinis, and you'll go blind. No. Anyway, so I decided to have this big cookout, and I invited over all my D.C. friends, and I invited all of Pink Martini and all of Blind Pilot. And it was just honestly one of my favorite nights in Washington, D.C., and I've lived here a long time. And this cookout sort of evolved or devolved as the night went on, and ultimately, as so many parties with Thomas Lauderdale do, it became a sing-along around the piano. And so we were upstairs in my house. This was a Monday night, and we're singing around the piano until, I don't know, 2, 3 in the morning. The next day, I'm sitting at my desk at work, popping Advil and coffee. And Thomas calls me and he says, hey, we've got an idea for a song that we want a man to sing on the next album. Why don't you sing it? And of course, I had been a Pink Martini fan since I was in high school. I loved this band. I would show up to all of these little clubs that no longer exist that maybe you remember, like La Luna or the Spring Onion? There was the Lebanese restaurant. Anyway, so I was a huge fan of Pink Martini. I loved these guys. I was friends with them. And the idea of singing with them was some kind of fantasy dream come true that I thought would never actually happen. But I said, yes, absolutely, of course. And so I went to Portland, went into the studio with them, recorded this song for the new album, at that point new, this was 2008, called But Now I'm Back, and thought that would be it. And then Thomas said, well, if you're going to keep performing with us, we need to find a time for you to do this live. How about the Hollywood Bowl?
So wow, that's a good,
time
that's
on
a good
stage
debut.
With the band, it was in front of 18,000 people in the Hollywood Hills. And the incredible thing, well, there are a lot of incredible things about the Hollywood Bowl, but backstage there are these big black and white photographs of the people who have performed there over the years. And so as you're waiting to go on stage, you're looking at these images of Jimi Hendrix and Judy Garland and the Beatles. And then you walk out on that stage and it's, you know, a beautiful, warm Los Angeles evening and people are drinking wine
and the tree
having
people.
A great time. It was just, it was quite a way to begin a singing career.
Oh, that's incredible. That must have been, what did it feel like to step onto that stage?
Well, you would think that it would be terrifying, and in a sense, I suppose it was, but it felt so, like the audience was rooting for me, you know, like cheering me on. Even though it's a huge, legendary, historic place, it also feels intimate, and it feels like it's a place that people have been coming since they were kids, and now they're bringing their kids and their families, and people are picnicking, and there's this kind of hum of cicadas in the background. So it was just a magical night.
That's incredible. Now, to leap from Pink Martini to coming back to singing and then this show, Homeward, which is going to be here in Portland in November, you're a veteran of war zones, you're a journalist. Did you have to be facile with lots of languages in order to do your job, or were languages always a part of your personal interest? Because I noticed all the beautiful international songs you're singing in your piece.
Yeah, so the songs in this show are in many different languages. I should clarify that while I have been to many war zones, I'm not in literal terms a veteran. I've been there as a reporter.
Right.
But as I was trying to put this show together, one reason that I had never done a show like this, even though people had asked over the years, is that I never felt like I had anything I wanted to say. I wasn't interested in just standing on stage for an hour and singing Gershwin and Sondheim tunes as much as I love Gershwin and Sondheim. I lived in London for a couple of years, and a friend of mine there was a cabaret reviewer, and he said that he thought that a lot of Americans misunderstand the difference between cabaret and musical review. They think that if you just get on stage and sing songs for an hour, you're doing a cabaret. And he said, no, that's a musical review. And if you want to do a cabaret, you have to really say something. You have to end someplace different than where you began. You have to have a connection with the audience and a reason for being there. And I never did a show like this because I never really felt like I had those things. And when I started putting this together, I thought about the places that I had been and the people that I had met and the stories that I had told. And I started thinking about how in all of these places, throughout all of these times, across thousands of miles, there's always a soundtrack. There's always music. Somebody is always listening to something or singing something or playing an instrument. And so I guess perhaps informed by my experience with Pink Martini, where we sing in so many different languages, I started finding music from the places that I had been. And I reached out to people who I had met covering these stories, and I said to a Syrian refugee, when you were crossing the Mediterranean, what was in your earbuds? And I said to people who had marched in the Maidan, the main square in Kiev, Ukraine, what were people singing as they marched? And so I gathered these songs. I found people to teach me the words in the languages, Kurdish, Ukrainian, Arabic, Scots Gaelic, and on and on. And I wove them in with the stories of the places that I had been and tried to tease out some larger life lessons. And so that's sort of what this show is.
One of the songs that seems to have one of those life lessons is Fils de by Jacques Brel and Gérard Jugnet. And tell us how you came on to that. Just the song, the meaning of the song is so breathtaking.
So this is a really good moment to offer my huge appreciation to my musical director, pianist, and collaborator, Gabriel Mangianti, who actually pointed me to that Jacques Brel song, because I had all of these stories of all these places I had been and all these songs that I had found, and I was looking for a way to start the show. And I was experimenting with a few different songs, none of which really seemed to work. And I knew the story that I wanted to tell and the point that I wanted to make, but I didn't know the song that would speak to it. And he introduced me to this song by Jacques Brel called Fiesta, which is about the young men who died during World War I. There are French lyrics and there are English lyrics. I sort of do the song half in French, half in English, and tell a story about World War I that, you know, I confess always felt a little bit obscure and difficult to understand until I was living in London at the 100th anniversary of the start of the war and saw an exhibition that really sort of snapped the conflict into focus for me. And that kind of provides the frame for this song that opens the show.
That's beautiful. And also, I have to ask how you came upon When the Earth Stopped Turning. Was that from you or from your music director? I just adore that song.
I love that song. And I've always loved that song, and I did not think of including it in this show until Gabe, my musical director, suggested it, and I will be forever grateful to him for that.
So when you're reporting for All Things Considered, do you use some of these languages, or is this mostly for your music?
No. I depend heavily on fixers, interpreters, local journalists. I just finished a big reporting trip to Indonesia and leaned heavily upon a terrific local journalist named Febriana, who helped me out. And, you know, to be a fixer in a situation like that, you have to, A, be a journalist, B, serve as an interpreter, which is an entirely different skill set, and C, be a good logician, you know, a logistics person to get from point A to point B to point C to point D, which for a big, ambitious two-week reporting trip is a lot to ask of a person.
How did it feel after you finished Homeward the first time at Joe's Pub? Did you feel satisfied with the arc, and or are you constantly fiddling?
Well, I actually have to say I did do it in Washington, D.C. Before Joe's Pub.
Oh, gotcha.
And when I did it in D.C. for the first time, I really didn't tell anybody about it because I kind of wasn't sure if it would work or if it would connect with the audience. And if it didn't, I wanted it to die a quiet death. And then I was really happy with how it went. So I brought it to Joe's Pub, which was such a thrill because this is a place where, even though it's a very intimate venue, so many cabaret legends who I admire so much have performed there over the years. And one of them actually joined me on stage for part of the show. I have a Scottish moment, which is a story about the Scottish independence referendum, and a song that every person from Scotland knows, which has a verse in Scots Gaelic. And one of the great advocates for Scottish independence came to the show, Alan Cumming, the theater and movie and TV star. And so before the show, I have been friends with Alan for a while, and I asked if he would be willing to sing a verse of this song, and he was so gracious and lovely about it, and to have him share the stage with me was just a remarkable experience. And so Alan Cumming won't be in Portland, but knock on wood, hopefully we'll have some other special surprise guests who will really make the Portland performances memorable as well.
I have to wonder, are your parents musical?
My parents both make music, but not as performers on stages. You know, my mother would always play the guitar and sing songs when we were little kids. And my mom and dad actually, before we were born, played duets on the recorder, you know, the sort of flute-like instrument. And so I would say that they are both musical, but neither of them is a performer per se.
Can you recall, you know, in the show when you've been performing Homeward, piece that really felt satisfying, both lyrically, musically, and really meshing with the story well, and kind of describe what that section is like?
Well, there's one song that is by a band from Syria that fled, and the song is called Bashara, which means in the streets. It's in Arabic, and the song sort of talks about liberation, and the band escaped war and death in order to survive. And so to tell that story while singing the song that they wrote, and as the story unfolds, so does the song, feels like a really kind of harmonious mesh of music and meaning. So that's always a moment of the show that I particularly appreciate.
That's wonderful. So as I said earlier, are you going to keep fiddling with it, or do you feel as though this is the show and it is set and ready to rumble, and will you do another?
I don't know. It's still so new to me that I'm open to seeing what happens. I am so lucky that I get to spend my work life hosting All Things Considered, and I get to spend some of my vacation time touring with Pink Martini, and now I'm spending some of my vacation time doing this solo show. And so ultimately, it's so fulfilling to do this show. I just have to see how it feels after doing it in Portland and see, well, do I want to take it to other cities? Do I want to make changes with it? Do I want to sort of put it to bed as, well, that was the time that I did it? And I'm not sure what the future holds.
It's interesting because I've thought often about concerts that I've done now that there are so many cities in very varying degrees of rebuilding due to so many natural disasters, how healing music is. And I thought, gosh, I really want to get in touch with organizations that are putting musicians out into the field to provide music for regenerating the spirit.
Yeah. And it's interesting for me as a journalist who is interacting with these communities in one way to then try something slightly different as a performer and relate to those experiences in a different way. And it's something that I was cautious about doing and sort of sensitive to doing delicately when I ultimately did decide to put this show together. I don't want to be cavalier about it, and I don't want to feel like I'm using other people's pain to create art. But I do want to try to make meaning out of these experiences I've had and try to tease some larger lessons out of them.
Well, the difference, I think, is the fact that actually these events are part of your life. You know, it's not someone from the outside singing about ideas that they really just an idea, but you've actually visited these places and interacted with, had relationships with these people. It's really beautiful.
But even then, it's as a journalist, you know, it's not my community that went through war, through revolution. It's always been as an observer, even though the people I've met are people who I have developed real affection for and remained in contact with and care about. It's still as the journalist, as the outsider.
Right. That's a great distinction, actually. So I'm curious, where are you mostly satisfied? I would think creatively might be both places. You know, recent stories for All Things Considered, music, you know, where's something that really just gave you joy?
Well, this reporting experience that I just had in Indonesia was incredible because it was not about a war or a natural disaster. It was about curiosity and telling stories that I think listeners will be eager to hear. And the experience of going to a place like this and doing a reporting project like this is very different from tourism, but in a way, it's almost better than tourism because you can follow your curiosity into places that tourists would not be able to go, and you can have experiences that are so different from what we are typically able to encounter in our daily lives. And, you know, I remember a couple years ago, I interviewed James Corden, the late night host, about his carpool karaoke segments. And he was talking about how incredible it is to him that he somehow actually gets paid to do this. And when I was in Indonesia, I felt the same way, that it is such a privilege to be able to spend my work life meeting people all over the world who are doing interesting things and learning about them and listening to them and engaging with them and then sharing that story with other people who appreciate hearing it. It's it makes you feel very lucky. And so I feel a lot of gratitude, and I don't take that for granted.
Well, I think we're going to be so happy to have you here in Portland to listen to Homeward, which is going to be at the World Trade Center November 16th at 7:30, November 17th, Friday at 7:30, Saturday, November 18th at 7 and 9. So two shows on Saturday, right?
Yes.
That's fantastic.
It means a lot to me to bring the show back to the city that I have called home. So yeah. I'm looking forward to it.
And I know everyone will want to know where to get tickets, and I found them on brownpapertickets.com.
Yes, if you just Google Ari Shapiro Homeward Portland, they are for sale on brownpapertickets.com, and I hope to see everybody there.
Yes, we certainly will all be there, and thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us, and I'm looking forward to hearing every single story that you follow.
Well, I really appreciate your interest. It's been wonderful talking to you. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Ari. Bye-bye.
This moment long ago, many a year we sighed in vain, for both of us knew many a moon would wax and wane before this dream came true. Together with music, together with music, the thought of it enchants us so. When those first tones crash out, we know beyond a doubt
that everything's gonna be divine.
Watch us rise and shine, riding as high as a kite. Our hearts are fantasy free, because long, long last we happen to be together with music.